All right, it's DT Systems, dog tested and dog tough. You know, we like that dog in them, baby. We've been using the H2O 1820. Over the last several months, we've been playing with this unit. Our friends at Standing Stone Kennels, Ethan and Kat, they've been using it for years, and we've been playing with it. We really like it. I think for the dog trainer, the hunter, and the guy or gal who's training their dog to get ready for duck season, we'll really enjoy the 1820. Super reliable, super consistent, great unit for you and your dogs. H2O 1820. Dog tested, dog tough. Gunner Kennels, baby. Hashtag man's best kennel. Well, it's also now hashtag man's best food crate. It's freaking raccoon proof. You can't get into this thing. Your dog can't bust into the lid and eat all the food. Trust me, I know Memphis has done it in the past. She looks like a blown up pumpkin. Boom. But not anymore. We've got the Gunner Kennel food crate. It's easy to pack, easy to store, keeps food dry, which food's an investment, man. That Purina, baby, it ain't cheap anymore. So keep it dry, good, all that stuff, easy to pack, easy to store. The Gunner Kennel food crate, slide into DMs if you'd like to learn more. It's force fetch, baby. It's the number one question we get asked. You don't know how to fix it? Let me help you. Let me get you to your goals. We built a course, bunch of videos. I think there's 13 or 14 videos start to finish on how you and your dog can get through the force fetch process successfully. The link's in the description. Be sure to check it out and let me help you and your dog.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
What's going on, everybody, and welcome to another episode of your Lone Ducks Gundog Chronicles, baby. We got a good one coming up. My buddy Mike Vaughn, a Bird Dog Wars Flushing World Champion, NBD, that means no big deal, is up. It's going to be a fun episode. He's super charismatic. I'm really excited to talk to him about genetics and strategy and conditioning and training and all the things that add up to creating a world champion flushing dog to go and win the Bird Dog Wars. But first, I'm going to give a quick shout out to the old Lone Duck Outfitters website. We've got some new t-shirt designs. Kevin asked me to pump that up. So check it out, loneduckoutfitters.com. If you like listening to this episode, if you learn a tidbit, if you ask some questions on the old Instagrams at Lone Duck, and I help you out, and you want to show a little appreciation, grab a hat, grab a t-shirt. We thank you. We got our e-collars and other stuff on there too, so if you need some more training supplies, they're there. But hey, if you just want to say a thank you, grab a hat. Also, if you're looking into training your dog and you want to have a little bit more one-on-one with the old Uncle Bob, Patreon. Patreon.com/LoneDuckOutfitters. We've got a growing community on there where we're talking about drills and marking setups and puppy training with Prairie, live Q&As like we do on Instagram, but more in depth with you and our friends in the community. It'd be great if you join. You know, for $5 a month, you're buying me and Kevin a beer for doing the podcast. We appreciate your support. Also, real quick, it enters you to win a Bad to the Bone hunt next year. What is it? 2021 waterfowl season.
Did we book that?
Yeah.
So that is booked.
And we need to have him on the podcast next week. Let's do that.
All right, cool.
Cool. Let's line him up for next week on the podcast. We're going to announce who we're doing the hunt with.
Stay tuned.
And if you join our Patreon, whether it's for the, you know, whatever tier you're in, if you're on our Patreon, patreon.com/LoneDuckOutfitters, you can win a hunt with me and Kevin, one of our buddies, one of our dogs. We're going, all expenses paid. Come shoot that Ooh, next up, bismuth. Kent, we're going to get you anything you need. You bring your own gun, I guess. Although, I guess we could supply you one if you're flying and you need a gun.
We can figure that out.
We'll figure that out if you win.
But we'll figure that out.
But all expenses paid. If you're on our Patreon, you're going to win. So, hey.
Whoa, you have a, you're not going to win. You have a chance to win.
Yes, sorry. Great point. We're not taking 100 and some people. Yeah, no. If you're a Patreon member, you're entered to win. So check it out. Buy us a beer. Help us get better equipment, better video equipment, all the stuff that provides us more information for you to help you with your dog. No big deal. And then on top of it, you're entered to win this Bad to the Bone hunt. It is a trophy style hunt. It is not shooting woodies or mallards or mergansers like I like to shoot.
There is nothing wrong with shooting some fine hoodies.
But
won't be that.
Yeah, this won't be hooded merganser shoot or common merganser shoot. I promise. This will be the legit. So check it out. Patreon.com/LoneDuckOutfitters. Next up, Yukonuba, baby. The food that fuels the truck. New formula. We talk about it every week, but I am encouraging you to do a 3-month challenge. That's 3 bags of Yukonuba. Get it on Chewy.com, super easy. You don't have to find it in a store. You don't have to drive anywhere. Just get on your little iPhone or whatever you got in that pocket and whip out Chewy.com. Order you up Yukonuba 3020 or 2616. That's going to be my suggestion for most of you listeners. 2616 or 3020. Get on it. Do the Yuk challenge for me and try it for 3 months. Tell me what you think. Next up. Gunna Kennels.
They got their food crate back in stock. We've had a few people asking, when is that coming? What's going on there? It's back in stock. They had such success with it, they sold out pretty quick. But they're back.
Like 2 days they sold out quick.
Yeah, it was bananas. But they're awesome. I love it. And they're back.
Yep, check it out. And if you're interested in getting yourself into some Gunner products, whether it's their kennel or adding some accessories to your kennel or the food crate, you can shoot us a direct message on Instagram, and we'll be happy to help you out, get you into one. Next up, Dogtra. Now, I don't know if you saw this on the old Instagrams, at Lone Duck, but I recently posted a picture from 2012. It was me, Kevin, our friend Dave, who was on the podcast a few months ago, and Buck, my first gun dog. And I made a comment about like how young we were and where it's taken us. And it was kind of a cute little post, you know, memory lane. And I also like parentheses. By the way, for all of you wondering if I'm really a Dogtra guy from way back in 2012, I had a Dogtra collar around my neck and around my dog's neck. So it's visual proof that I stand behind the products and I've stood behind them for a really, really long time. Quality customer service. I trust them. Try them out. If you're in the market for one, you can get on Lone Duck and check it out or shoot me a direct message and I'll answer some questions. But check them out. Dogtra on Instagram. It's Dogtra Official. Next up, smoke them if you got them, baby. Those Traeger grills. I recently smoked a Boston butt, a little pulled pork, and the butt was really good. It was the best one I've ever done. But what I loved on the app, you can just like Google. Well, you can't Google it. It's the app. But you search on the app like what you're cooking, and it'll give you recipes. So I picked a recipe that sounded good, and I made my own barbecue sauce, which, guys, I'm being serious. I suck at cooking. I picked one that sounded good, and I had most of the ingredients, and then that sounds good, and it sounds like this. So I added that because I didn't have this, and then a little bit of this because I didn't have that. And bingo, bango, bongo, I had this sauce that I swear to you was like God's sweat dripping from the heavens onto my pork, and he just sweat this liquid, and I just ate it with the pork, and it was so good that tonight I had a little bit left over, and I just was dipping bread in it. It was so good. So Traeger, if you got it in the budget, get you a Traeger, baby. You will not be disappointed, and the app that comes with it.
Well, the app's free. You can, if anybody wants to check that out, that's free.
Oh,
All right. So if you, for recipes or anything like that, I mean.
Sweet. Well, I didn't know that, but either way. Some. Yeah, get you some. The recipes on there really make me seem like I know what I'm doing. Next up, Kent. I had mentioned it before.
I already mentioned the business, but.
Give them the business with the bismuth. Not, I don't need to say anything more.
Enough said.
Shoot them with that bismuth, baby. I don't know why we're shooting steel still. That's the real deal. Why shoot them with steel?
Get the real deal.
Bismuth. Wow. All right. Every week we're going to come up with a new tagline. Why shoot them with steel? Get the real deal. ... Bismuth.
I'm going to have to put in some phone calls and just.
Yeah,
the t-shirt machine is coming.
Yeah, the t-shirt machine's coming, and we're going to be head of marketing at Kent any day now. it's happening, baby. All right, lastly, Waypoint Outdoor Collective. I think that's it, right, Kev?
Yeah, Waypoint Outdoor Collective. They also reposted the picture of you, me, Buck, and Dave Instagram. Yeah, they said it was cute.
Nice.
Memory Lane. Yep. Good people. Fine people over there.
Check them out on Instagram, Waypoint Outdoor Collective. All right, let's get into the show. Now, into Mike Vaughn, hailing from Wisconsin, Bird Dog Wars champion, back to back, the man, the myth, the legend. Mike, thank you for coming on the show. Do me a favor, tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, guys, I'm happy to be here. I'm Mike Vaughn from Wisconsin with the Black Wing Shooting Kennels, or a facility that trains retrievers for upland and waterfowl, and we do hunt tests and upland bird dog tournaments, some qualifying field trials as well. But mainly on the hunt test side, we do HRC and AKC butt. So that's kind of what we specialize in here. We do some pointers as well.
Yeah, that's something that we'll dig into a little bit more because for everybody who doesn't know and probably wouldn't know because it was through the summer, like when we were qualifying for Master National, that didn't happen. Me and the dogs rolled out to Wisconsin and Michigan to run a test, and I got to meet Mike in Wisconsin in his home state and run a test together, and we hit it off, and so we're glad to have him on the show. But we also, not commiserate, but sort of, and also just chatted about it. He likes to dabble in the old pointing world too, so he's got an English pointer, and I've got the English setters, and so we talked a lot about that too. So we'll get into that more as the episode goes on. But Mike, one of the little ways you got, I'm going to jump right into this. You got kind of famous via the Bird Dog Wars.
Yeah.
Can you tell everybody what that is and where they can watch it? And like, how, like from start to finish, man, I'm so intrigued by the game and where it started and how you got into it and made a name for yourself in it.
Yeah, and that's a big open question there. But, well, kind of let's just describe Bird Dog Wars for a second. Bird Dog Wars actually has been going on since the 2000s. It's just that later on in, like, 16, 17, they started Bird Dog Wars as a little bit more reality TV show so that you could get more of an inside view of the travel, the competitors, the bickering, the training back and forth, where the old show used to just be like, up next is Mike Vaughn with this dog. Up next is Bob Owens with this dog. You know, it was kind of a little more rudimentary. This Bird Dog Wars kind of came and sat down at your house and said, hey, what are you thinking? What are you training? How are you doing? What kind of dog takes to win this thing? You know, who do you think you got to beat this season? And that's kind of where Bird Dog Wars came from. And there's a lot of great stories I can give you behind the scenes and stuff too, but that's Bird Dog Wars. However, it's basically off of the National Bird Dog Circuit, what we call BDC. So you're going to hear me say BDC a lot, which is National Bird Dog Circuit, which you can look up online. And it's basically the easiest way to describe it is it's a rodeo circuit for upland bird dogs. They have a pointing division on one side, and they have a flushing division on the other side. So the best flushing dogs in the country compete against each other, and the best pointing dogs in the country compete against each other. Much like, you know, hunt tests and stuff like that, where you're competing against a standard, and then you got qualifying field trials, and then you got obviously amateur and open in the AKC field trial world. Well, this is an actual, I'm going to show you I got a better bird dog than you, just like you're going to show me you got a better blind or blind running and marking dog than me. You know, SRS, ATC, stuff like that. So kind of what got me into it and what got me rolling in it is, you know, I just needed a break from life. When I went to my martial arts school, I was a martial arts instructor, and we actually fought in a cage, and that was my rush, was cage fighting. And I owned a martial arts school for 11 years in Madison, Wisconsin. And, you know, my business coach just kind of said, hey, man, you're a little crazy with the fighting in the cage. And you can't do that the rest of your life. So what do you want to do to, you know, start taking your time away from your business and getting off the fight game? And I said, I think we'll get a bird dog now, because I had beagles when I was a kid. And I actually had a field champion beagle, Northern Michigan Harehound Association. It's actually big over in New York, and Maine over by you guys too. It was really big back in the 2000s and the 90s, beagle field trials. I actually started out in that when I was a kid and got that going. I was 13, and my beagle was a field champion. He was in Northern Michigan and Wisconsin and Lower Michigan High Hound of the Year in 1999. He went to the Nationals and placed a fifth. There's a National just like there is in everything else we do. So, yeah, that's kind of the start as a kid.
So can I pause?
Martial arts.
Hold on real quick. Yeah, I want to learn more about that beagle. What was that sucker's name?
Got it. Yukon. Part of my friend, she's a badass. I mean, you got to think about that. You got to think about a 13-year-old kid who's, you know, just crazy about competing beagles in Wern, Wisconsin. At the time, the snowshoe hare pot. I mean, he's born in 1996, right? So you got to think at that time that, you know, all we got is, you know, you can't drive a car or nothing yet. All you can do is grab your beagle and go to your neighbors, and there's snowshoe hares everywhere, you know? And at that point, you know, you start running, and then you realize, holy crap, there's a competition to this thing. And then before you know it, you're a judge. And before you know it, you get your first car, and you start driving these things, and you join a beagle club, and you start meeting all these guys that are getting into sport and support you along the way. And before you know it, you got a dog that's whipping everybody.
Wow.
You know, and the funny part about it is kind of like us, kind of like going to qualifying or going to a Bird Dog Wars tournament. You know, you go there with multiple dogs at times and know that you got multiple dogs that can do it. In this case, you got to think that I got one dog, and his name's Yukon, and I'm a kid, and, you know, there's no GPS back then. There's no, all I got is a map and a few quarters in the truck to call home to let my parents know I'm okay. And, of course, I tell my parents that it's only an hour away when it's about 6 hours. Yeah. So I figured, yep, I'm fine. I've made it. You know, I call them when I'm 4 hours still to get there and told them I made it, you know, earlier than what I've gotten there. So, and you go there and he wins. And, you know, the thing about it was at the time he had won so much that there was no denying, because he had won out of so many different judges. So it wasn't like the same pair of judges constantly saying, yeah, we're going to help this kid out and get him a field champion. It's like everywhere I took him was different judges, and he was winning underneath lots of different eyes, you know.
That's so cool. So, what do they have to do to win that? How does a dog win that?
So I ran at the time. There's two divisions in beagles, and I'll make it short and sweet and simple. They measure them. They actually measure a beagle, and they got the 13-inch class. And they got males and females, 13-inch class that run on Saturdays. Then they got the 15-inch class, and the males and females run on Sundays. And I ran it. Mine was a 13-inch male. Now, what they had, and it's really cool stuff, and like I said, it's totally all by you guys too, is they had like 80-acre enclosures that they trapped snowshoe hare from the outside, and they brought them in there. Well, there was all trails cut in them, just everywhere, like logging roads. Mm-hmm. And what they would do is you would get in the morning, you'd have to be there, obviously, way before, and you would enter, and they would paint a number on the side of your dog. You'd have to get a measure, okay, they measured in, and then you'd have to walk over to the paint stand, they'd paint your number on the dog. Now, when a hare comes across the trail, there's a judge there writing down what number's first, what number's second, what number's third, what number's, you know, and getting as many numbers as he can that's taking that line perfectly. You know, and keeps writing down score of how they're going. Now, let's say that a rabbit comes out and makes a 90-degree turn, and the front-end dogs blow over it. Well, they're going to look and see what number recovers that rabbit, turns and makes it, what they call a check, you know. That's basically how you score it. And I just had a real fast-running, hard-hitting dog that was really good on the checks and really good in the front, and did it the right way and just impressed a lot of people and made my childhood very memorable.
That's super cool. Oh, UConn.
Yeah.
In the Beagle measuring contest.
And I got to pull up the picture. I got the pictures at my house here downstairs, and I got to get them pulled out because I want to put them up in my clubhouse, in my hunt club out here, and get a picture blowing up of them because it was a big time, good time.
That's so cool, man. I've hunted over Beagles once, and I think about it every year that I want to do it again, and I don't know anybody. There's so few. It's like, houndsmen are almost, I hate to say it, but like a dying breed, man. They're not.
So sad.
Yeah, it is. And every guy I know that has Beagles is old.
And it's hard because of the land thing nowadays. You know, everybody's deer nuts. In my area, everybody's deer nuts. So, you know, everybody's buying 40 acres and think that they're hoarding the deer on their property with their two food plots.
Right, you know? Right. Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's what's going on in my area. And then we actually got a problem with wolves. So it kind of, you know, hurt some people that way, that people were getting sick of dogs getting killed by wolves. So
that's crazy.
We actually have a big problem in Wisconsin with wolves, but they're starting to let us control that again now. They just took them off the species list here. So, you know, but yeah, I mean, and then the other side of it is, you know, it was harder when we were younger. You know, I mean, if you remember, and I don't know, and a lot of people relate to this, if you've been around it, is, you know, I had a telemetry tracking system. So every time I didn't know which way the dogs were, I had to pull this pack off my back and beep, 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 beep. Well, it just tell me what direction they were. It didn't tell me how far away they were.
Right.
Nowadays, I got the Garmin Alpha TT100 for my pointer, and it could tell me, yep, he's 125 yards on point.
Right.
You know, in the Grouse Woods. I mean, it's amazing nowadays.
Totally different world now.
Totally different game now with that type of technology.
That's super cool, man. So, you know, the Beagle started out UConn, by the way, phenomenal name.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Yeah. What a name. That's great. And then you got into martial arts and you started to talk about it before I cut you off. So now, you know, how did that begin? Where did that process start?
Well, and it kind of goes into the dog training later on because I did martial arts with my dad since I was 6 years old. That was kind of the gift my dad gave me. I mean, we grew up great. I didn't have a bad childhood. Just, you know, not a lot of extra money on the table. So my dad and I did martial arts together 2 days a week and still train together today. So, like, we got our black belts together. And then my dad was actually the corner man for my first MMA fight ever. And martial arts just kind of became the thing that we did. Because my dad's only 18 years apart from me.
Cool.
He had me when he was young. So we get to share a lot of time together, which is great. And so then working at a factory and following the family traditions of, you get a factory, you get health insurance, and you know, that's what you do the rest of your life. Then you support a factory in your town for the next 4 years, and then you die.
Right.
I kind of was like, you kind of have I got in a bad car accident in 2000, and that kind of woke me up and said, well, I'm not going to sit in a factory for 40 years and let my life run away. I got aspirations. So realistically, I moved to Madison, Wisconsin, which is 2 hours south of where I live. I live by Wausau, Wisconsin now, which is where I grew up. I moved back here, but I moved down to Madison, Wisconsin with some friends and said, here we go. I have no idea what I'm doing, but I'm going to open up a martial arts school. I just don't know when it's going to happen. And then it happened about a year and a half after moving there. And then I built it to be the number one adult school in Madison, Wisconsin during my time I owned it.
Good for you. What kind of martial arts was your specialty?
Yeah, my specialty was Muay Thai kickboxing. I was undefeated in Muay Thai kickboxing in full contact matches with a 6-0 record. And then I transitioned to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu because I have a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt under Marcelo Monteiro from Brazil. And then we obviously went to MMA. But my main specialty off of that, of how I got all started, was actually Bruce Lee's Jeet Kune Do. I'm actually a third generation Bruce Lee student, which is pretty cool, which many people can't say.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was Bruce Lee's right hand man was Dan Inosano, and that was his best friend. Dan Inosano trained my instructor, Paul Bunak, and then I got certified under Paul Bunak out of California. But I actually have met Dan Inosano, Bruce Lee's right hand man and best friend, and actually trained with him and trained with him at his school in Los Angeles and everything. So it's pretty cool.
That is cool, man. I would imagine that it's similar to the dog world, and we've talked about this on the show, and you'll agree to it, but hence why you're on our show tonight. Like, the places that the dogs take us, the people that we meet, the experiences we get, I'm sure that's similar in martial arts, where it's like, well, I guess we'll go to this tournament, or I guess we'll go out here and try this school for X amount of time, and you just, the opportunities and the people and the experiences is unbelievable.
Yeah, and I think the dog world's a little more genuine than the martial arts world, because the martial arts world has a lot more ego, not that the dog world don't, but I feel the dog world is a little more compassionate. But yeah, very much similar, you know, and very much similar. And, you know, another thing that we could touch on, and I'm sure you're going to probably want to touch on, is very much similar on that you got to have a curriculum and you got to build students, right? And you got to have a formula for success, you know?
Yeah.
So, and that's kind of where dog training became easy for me, because I had already been doing that for 13 years in my martial arts school.
Sure. You know? Starting with something raw and building it.
Right. Right.
That's super cool.
So that's, you know.
That's super cool. So transition from, you know, martial arts, you're fighting, you're doing your thing, and then you make the decision to move on. How did that come about?
Yeah, so at the time, I didn't go to college, so I had a business coach, which was pretty neat. What the business coach would just do is basically focus on my business with me two times a week. Vision charts, you know, just get you your bottom line, your budgets, just really like just hone in and help you with your business to take it to another level. And one of his vision charts was, you know, where do you want to be in 10 years? What do you want to do? How do you want to live? What do you, and you know, I was in the city at the time, and you can't take the country out of a country boy, right? So I, you know, I said, eventually I want to be back on 40 acres and I want to be back living in the country and I want to have some dogs again. And I want to get back to, you know, being in the country, because I can't take the city. This isn't where I'm meant to be. It's just a phase in life I'm in with this career right now. And so he told me, get your first bird dog. And this is where UConn is the Beagle story. And this is where the first dog was named after my martial arts instructor, Master Toddy, who was my Muay Thai instructor in Las Vegas at the time. So I named my first dog Pulse Master Toddy. And his name was Toddy. He's a big white male. He had a half show pedigree, a wilderness Harley to go, like fifth generation in the background, but rocking nose and about 75 pounds, powerful built, pure white polar bear dog. More athletic than a show dog, even though he had it. He had longer legs. But you know, I mean, you get a real reality check when you're all pumped about this dog. He's doing great. Then you want to start taking him in a hunt test world, take him in a tournament world, and, you know, I'll stay there for a minute. And then he's got grade 3 hip dysplasia. You know, you find out when he's 2 years old.
Right.
You know, so you get shattered immediately on your first dog, you know.
Been there with my first dog. So,
yeah, and so you kind of, you're getting into it, and as you know, and I'm sure anybody that's going to be listening to this knows, so you get in the dog world, and if you haven't yet, it's going to happen to you at some point in time. The passion of dogs gets in you so much that it gets addicting. And so pretty soon you're studying pedigrees like crazy, and then I just realized that, you know, this could be something I really want to do. And then at the time, the recession was happening in 08, so my martial arts school was a little rocky, and I was like, you know, I'm just kind of going to start doing this dog thing on the side here. And that basically came from the fact that my dog was trained by a pro trainer who was just a gun dog trainer. And I'm sure there's a lot of people in similar situations. You might even have a similar story, but I basically went out to this guy thinking that he knew everything, and he did four sessions with dogs, because I called him, and I'll back up a little bit here. I went to my first bird dog tournament with Toddy. So I'm just putting birds over him, right? I don't really know what I'm doing. I'm reading what you can and doing what I can. And I got guys at local pheasant hunt clubs helping me. I get referred to a local pheasant club, and they're helping me basically gun condition my dog and put pheasants over him. And that's where my passion upland came, which leads into bird dog wars that we're getting to. But, and so I'm getting helped out. Well, they said, we think you being an MMA fighter and you being a competitive guy and being younger, you know, I'm probably 28, 29 at the time. They're like, you should try this upland bird dog tournament. It's just a local club event. Yeah. Hey, that'd be awesome. I used to run beagles when I was a kid. Hey, I'd like to compete with a dog. Let's do it. Well, not realizing that I have to shoot the birds one shot at a time. My dog has to bring them back to hand. You know, I'm kind of just a novice of, you know, go out and shoot. And I may take me 3 times to get a bird down, and not realizing how much is really into it, you know. And so I go out there. Well, what the guy kind of says to me in the first one I run, he says, "Man, you got a hell of a dog, but you need force fetch." Mm. You know, and of course you're like, "What's force fetch?"
Sure.
You know, the dog, I'm killing the birds, bring them back. You know, he won't bring them, and he's standing 10 yards from me while the clock's ticking. You know, which I'll talk about some importance of this stuff a little bit later. But you know, and the clock's ticking, and pretty soon I got to go take a partial, which kind of step off from you guys. A partial means that the dog didn't bring the bird all the way to me. I have to go over and pick the bird up where he dropped it. Well, the clock automatically moves ahead 2.5 minutes when you got to move to go help the dog get a bird.
Oof.
So that's just like crazy amount of time. You just get burnt, you know. So anyway, that tournament starts out. I do it. It gets my feet. But while I'm up there, I meet some other guys. Said there's another one next weekend, like an hour from where I was at a different hunt club. So I want to go down there. So I meet some other people. While I'm down there, guys say the same thing. Hey, man, that dog just needs to be force-fetched. Once you learn to shoot better and that dog gets force-fetched, you guys are going to be a hell of a pair. And so I did what any local person would do, right? You Google your pro trainer and what's in the area and see if you got somebody that could force-fetch it, you know? And so a kennel came up and he force-fetched him to good and he got him, and I had him partially. I tried to do it on my own, but as we all know, it's super hard to learn when you don't know what to do. It's still super hard to do, even not super hard to do, but it's, you know, you don't force fetch every dog the same hardly at all. And so you're kind of like, you go through it, he gets force fetched. Well, then the trainer kind of made a big mistake. He says, you know what, Mike, the dog's trained now, and if you just come out and help me throw birds, I'll let you come out here and help me continue training and move forward. Well, that's when I got introduced to blinds. And the first time I saw a blind, you know, I'm sure like most people, probably even yourself, I mean, it's just fascinating, right? Like, I mean, the first time you see one, like,
right,
no way you can get a dog to do this. Like, I never seen one. I've seen a dog run, and when I look back at it, a basic 75-yard blind, and thought it was the coolest thing I had ever seen in my life.
Yep.
You know? And the upland thing is, you know, fascinating too, but I mean, at the time, right? How can you have this much control? So I start going to the guy, and a story that I kind of really want to touch on right now is, and I think this will be helpful to a lot of people, is I got going with this guy, and I actually started realizing as I started studying along with him, and we got to the swim by. And to cut out, I buy my next dog, Bella, out of Toddy, because, you know, obviously I'm devastated from the hip dysplasia. So I buy a dog, Bella, and I'm going to take her through the whole thing now. I'm going to take this dog. And my time at the goal was just senior hunter. Master seemed far-fetched, but senior hunter. And I'll just fast forward to the fact that this dog's great. She's doing great. She's going through it. The T-work great. Everything's going good. And we get to the swim by, you know, this infamous swim by, you know, which nowadays is even more controversial. But we get to the swim by, and I'm like, the way that he's teaching this dog to do the swim by, or that he's teaching me and telling me how to do, he is fighting and eating these dogs up, you know. And my ex-wife actually was with me at the time, and she's like, Mike, if we got to train dogs like this, I don't want you doing it.
Right.
You know,
right.
Because you're a martial arts instructor. You're smarter than this. There's something not right here, you know. So I got into, you know, a simple pace system, and you know, I give a shout out to the time who helped me a lot, which is Evan Graham. I mean, he helped me a lot at this stage in the game. And realize at this point now how much this trainer didn't know, thought he knew, you know.
Sure.
And from that point on, like, realized, okay. And then pretty soon him and I kind of got into a tiff because, you know, I was training dogs better than he was. But I was willing to evolve because I was younger. I wasn't a 65-year-old man that thought my way was right because I did it the last 20 years. I was willing to evolve like a martial arts instructor to figure out the right way that was the better benefit for the dog.
Right.
You know? And so at that time, I had referred to people to him. They weren't happy with the results, and they just said, Mike, you want to train? So I just started leasing kennels from him, and then eventually, you know, broke away from him and started doing it on the side, which then eventually pretty much took over to where I was traveling, went to the Master National and all that stuff. You know, and then pretty soon it was like, okay, the martial arts school, going through a divorce always puts you on a sidetrack. So that was always another tough time in life. You know what? I need to just walk away from the martial arts school. I need to walk away from being around. I need to hit the road, and much like yourself, get on the Master National Trail and start meeting these people and get my mind off and just hit the road and, try a new lifestyle here and see how this rolls, you know.
So what year was that when you went professional?
I trained my first professional client in 2010. And the whole time I'm learning the tournament game, I never left the tournament game.
Cool.
You know, in terms of you're wanting to catch up on Bird Dog Wars. So I basically, there was, and I'll kind of bridge over to that again, because that's where we're wanting to lead to this, is that there was a dog, there's Holzinger Kennels in Minnesota, and I kind of modeled myself after them. You might have heard of him before. He's pretty popular kennel in Minnesota. But anyway, they had Upland tournament dogs that they ran throughout the winter, and then they had hunt test dogs that they ran in the summer. And as you know, or maybe people don't know, and it's a good thing for people to know, is that, you know, hunt tests were designed to have to prepare your dogs throughout the summer to be ready for hunting.
Right.
That's what the original design was, right? That you know and I know. To, in the off season, get them ready for the season. Well, tournaments, Upland Bird Dog tournaments, were to extend your pheasant season. So when your pheasant season ended in December, you could Upland Bird Dog tournament hunt until April.
That's so awesome.
Yeah. So it became, and still is now, and I'm back to it now because I went down the hunt test trail a little too deep for a little while there. Another thing we could touch on later, but this would literally be my life. January, I would go down to Texas and train from January until April. I'd come home, we'd do hunt tests all the way until, September, and then we'd instantly switch gears and get ready for the World Championships in October, and I'd be doing bird dog tournaments from October all the way until April. Until January, or pheasant hunting and hunting and tournaments till January. And then I'd be doing tournaments while in my off time, you know? So now my season just rolls that 5 or 6 months out of the year, I'm on Upland dogs, and 5 or 6 months out of the year, I'm on, hunt test dogs. But back to the Holzinger Kennels I'm bringing, I kind of modeled my business after them because they were very popular at producing dogs that were phenomenal Upland Bird Dog tournament dog winners and pheasant hunters and master hunters by the time they were 2 years old. And that, to me, there was this dog named Raymer's Instant Cash Machine, and you can look him up. He's one of the number one BDC dogs. He was running when I got into it in like 06, 07, 08. He passed away like 2 years ago. He produced a lot of good dogs. Unfortunately, once the EIC came out, he was an EIC carrier, so a lot of people didn't breed to him anymore, but he was like the model. He was a 2-year-old master hunter, and he was winning national world championships, and he was a pheasant hunting machine. And up until this point, if you remember, Bob, everybody's telling you, oh, you can't do that. You can't have an Upland Bird Dog if you want to go run hunt tests. You can't have an Upland Bird Dog if you want to go run qualifying. There's no way you can do that. You got to wait until you get your master title, and then you can go Upland hunting. And by that time, you created such a good bootlicker that you can't get them away from your heel. You know, so, So I kind of, from this point, I've gotten known, and realistically, my business is known for, I have produced more national and world Upland champions and master hunters combined at 2 years old than anybody in the country.
No way.
That would be kind of my forte. Yeah, there's nobody who's produced as many Upland champions and master hunters at 2 years old than I have.
So tell me what it takes to be the Upland side of it. I mean, we talk a lot on this podcast about master hunters and AKC hunt tests, so I feel like we can separate that without diving in.
But
if they've already listened enough and know what it takes to do that, now educate them on your world or that side of your world and what it means to be that kind of dog.
Oh man, I'm so happy you guys are asking these questions because I've been boiling at the seams to get this off my chest of this stuff. Okay. Let me start with that. Not every dog can be a great Upland dog. And let me start with this. Okay. There's a difference between, there's two types of Upland dogs. And let me tell you in terms of intelligence. So let's start with this. There's a dog who runs around and smells a bird and thinks it smells good, and he runs over there and he flushes the bird and you shoot it and he brings it back to hand. Okay? So he's basically hanging out with you, taking a walk. He smells a good scent. He flushes it. He brings it back to you. Okay? Then there's an upland bird dog that we've created who's a bird assassin who the whole time he's running, which is comes from our pointer world, as you know as well. We actually, in the upland world, borrow a lot of pointer tactics for our retrievers. And who is running with birds on their mind. You know, they're quartering. You give them a quartering pattern. You teach them how to run lines in the field, which I'll get into a little bit more for the tournament circuit when we get into bird dog wars a little deeper. But a dog literally learns how to run lines the same as we would teach him a blind or marking. Okay? And they're running the field thinking about birds the whole time. And that dog will stay on the ground all day or until it dies. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you got to be careful because you can kill that dog. He's genetically gifted and he's got such a strong mentality that, and he's athletic because I want to get in touch on the genetic side of things, but, and you can get there. So I think it's so like me owning a hunt club and I'm putting birds up to people and they come back and tell me how great their dogs. And don't get me wrong. My hunt club's all about the dogs. I want to hear the dog stories because I want to hear people be excited about their dogs because that's what we do as trainers, right? But I think there's very much a fallacy across this whole United States of what a good upland dog is. And sit to the flush definitely isn't it. But I'll, I can touch on more of that stuff. So going on, kind of just diving into it right away, I want to create a dog that is a bird assassin that all it thinks about is birds on its mind. And then I need that same dog to go out there with so much power and be so accurate with his bird finding ability that I can win $10,000 this weekend and come home, you know, with after my entry fees, $8,000 richer.
Right.
Because Bird Dog Wars is a rodeo circuit for bird dogs. So for you guys that want to understand, I keep saying Bird Dog Wars with BDC, but we'll just use the phrase Bird Dog Wars, which you can find on YouTube, by the way. 40% of the entry fee goes back into a payout, just like a rodeo. And throughout the year, the database is holding your points of what you're doing. So you're trying to get your points built up to get to the dog of the year runoff, which happens in nationals in March. So like I'm building up for March right now, and I got in the dog of year runoff with Journey, you know. But my points accumulated for the 2020 season, so the National Cup is going to say National 2020 champion because it was the 2020 season that I qualified that dog in.
Okay.
You know, if that makes sense. You know, like the cup, even though if I win it this year in 2021, it'll actually be the 2020 national champion.
Because next fall it starts over.
Yep. Well, it actually starts over at January 1st. So our season started over right now for 2021 right now. But our end of our season is March after the year is over. You know, that's our national championship.
Okay.
Does that make sense to you?
Meh.
Kevin, that makes sense to you too? Or?
No.
So, wait a minute.
No.
Bob's not a math guy.
No, dude.
Again. It started last year. It's like in some sports, it's the 2021 season or whatever, but they can't write so many damn numbers on the plaque, so this is a 20 season.
So, like, you're doing it for 2020. And then in March is the championship.
Right.
But even in January 1st, 2021, you're starting to accumulate points for 2021. So they don't go towards the championship in March. It rolls over.
Yeah, but it'll go. So I'll try to explain a little bit easier is that March is the finale of the 2020 season. So I'm going to win the 2020 national championship, but I'm actually going to win it in 2021.
Right.
Yeah.
But starting January 1st.
Yep, it starts for 2022 national.
Okay. All right. I'm with you.
I think I got you a little baffled, but yeah.
I'm with you. You know, I understand.
Instead of the national championship being December 31st, you know, you got to accumulate the points all the way till December 31st. Then they give you 2 months to put everything together
and
organize the national championship 2 months. And then you go compete to be the 2020 national champion.
I'm with you.
And the 2020 dog of the year. Yeah. So
how many of these are going on? Like we don't, do we have them in New York? I've never even heard of one in New York. Do we have them in Ohio?
You used to have it. Yeah, you have the New York Bird Dog series, what you guys used to have. Actually, there's a very popular, some associations will call sanction. So basically, there's like three big tournament organizations in the United States, and BDC was the most popular because it had a TV show following it. Then there's called UFTA, which is United Field Trawlers Association, which is still a tournament association. And then you got NUX, which is National Upland Classic Series. All of them have their own national. All of them have their own thing. But NUX and UFTA were a derivative of BDC. BDC was the leader and the oldest running tournament hunting organization.
Okay.
So, yes, they're out in New York. They're in Lower Michigan. They're in Ohio. They're in North Carolina, South Carolina.
How do people find them to enter them?
You go right on the National Bird Dog Circuit website.
Okay.
And you go around there and find all the events. They list the events for the whole year.
Heck yeah.
So that's kind of, you know, that, and they can, you can organize an event within 21 days to kind of keep watching it. Cause you know, sometimes you'll, I run an event here at my hunt club and at my place the second weekend of September every year, one of the biggest ones. So to explain this a little more to all you guys and everybody else listening, is the BDC has what's called super majors, and super majors is basically, there's five big tournaments a year. And those five big tournaments a year are the biggest point tournaments. So you could basically, the easiest way to describe them would be regionals. So go to the regional tournaments and get bigger points to get you to that end of the year runoff that you're looking to get to, you know.
Okay.
Each one of those comes with their own championship cup, and each one of those comes with their own big payout. Now, the number one biggest tournament of the season is the national championship. And that's where you'll see all the best players and dogs in the country.
And where is that hosted? Or does it change?
This year it'll be at a beautiful place in Palmer, Kansas called Scattered Acres. They do a phenomenal job there. And it's just an hour and a half southwest of Kansas City.
Okay.
And they keep it kind of centrally located because people come from Nevada, California, Texas, you know, like your side is Ohio, New York, Wisconsin, Minnesota, South Dakota. You know, I mean, people come from around the world. I mean, when people come to my tournament, some people are driving 30 hours to get here.
Holy crap.
Yeah. So it's a lot bigger than what the viewers or what you guys would know it is. It's a lot bigger.
I want in, dude.
I feel like I'm a little hurt that we didn't get a phone call.
I know. I'm like 6 to midnight right now.
But, like, we're there. Like, we got to go.
And you guys, I'm going to tell you, man, there's no adrenaline like it. I mean, and here's the thing that's so cool. You know what I mean? We're talking about bird dog tournaments, and there's so much I could describe about it. But one of the other cool things is, you know how hunt fests are, right? Like, me and you. You're there in New York. You come from New York. You're in Wisconsin. Nobody's really talking to you. They don't know who you are. They see your plates. I come rolling up back into you. Hey, what's up, buddy? Hey, me and you strike the conversation. That's the reason why we're talking tonight, right?
Correct.
Well, I'm just used to that because of Upland Bird Dog Tournament. That's just the way I am. Like, that's how everybody is. It's like, I'm going to take your money today, Bob. But hey, tonight, let's have a beer and talk about how I took your money and how maybe next time you can try to take mine.
I love it. I love you know? It.
And that's how cool it is. It's not I'm a better trainer than you, I'm a better player than you. And there's a few of those guys, but, you know, so what? That's everywhere, you know. In general, like at the national championship that's coming up, it's such a cool gathering because by day we're like, we're going to win this, I'm getting to the finals. And by night, you're all at the bar inside the hunt club talking about how your runs went and supporting each other and what's next and what's going on tomorrow. And the national championship is really cool because it's a different tournament every day. Like, Journey qualified this year to be in the Dog of the Year runoff, and we do that on Monday. And then Tuesday, the under the 2-year-old puppies run to try to get to the finals on Friday. Then Wednesday is the doubles. Now, the doubles is you and Kevin run against with the dog. My doubles partner is probably the number one player in the country, and his name's Tim Samuelson, and you'll hear me mention him a lot. And so him and I are pretty unstoppable.
But that's before we've come out and had a go at it. That's like you're saying he's a current, right?
Yeah. We're the underdogs.
Exactly.
We're coming in
you
hot.
Just wait, baby.
2022, baby.
Yeah. you guys just get out here to one of my seminars this summer, and I'll show you how to beat me in. Good luck.
Oh, yeah. All right. Down for a good time.
Oh, yeah. I'm like the only guy in the country that teaches people about this game with the seminars at my place.
That's cool.
You know, everybody else tries to keep the secret to themselves.
Nah, yeah, you can't. That's why we do the podcast. So doubles, it's like you got a shooter, you and the dog, or it's two dogs working together with two dudes?
Nope. One dog and two guys. So, and I'm going to tell you, here's another training tactic that most people don't do. So I'm just going to try to get this to go in your head, see if you guys can hang with me on this ride. So we take off from the gate, which the gate is where we start. And as soon as we leave the gate, the clock starts, okay? And let me give you a real fast rundown. When we shoot a bird, we have to stand still with one basketball step. We got to leave 1 foot planted and take the retreat. We cannot advance on a dog after we shoot. Once we shoot, our 1 foot needs to remain planted, all right? When we shoot, it needs to be one shot per bird. If we shoot two shots to kill the bird, the clock jumps forward 2.5 minutes.
Oh. All right,
first shot.
So I'm definitely not bringing right. Kevin. 100% not bringing Kevin.
So going back to the double thing, and then the clock stops when the last bird's in hand. All right? So the clock starts when we leave the gate. Clock starts when the last bird's in hand. So you got a partner, and you develop this, you know, chemistry between you two of knowing the field, dissecting it together with one dog, and handing the dog off over to him now. Now he's dissecting his side of the field. And then there's a time to hand the dog off to me, and I got to dissect my side of the field until we got five birds in a bag in the fastest time possible.
That's right.
Preferably one shot each, you know.
How long is this? Like 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half hour, an hour?
Well, we want to be, okay, you got 15 minutes in the field as your time, and probably a 5 to 10 acre field. But we want to be done in preferably a minute a bird is our goal. A minute a bird we want to be done in. So 5 minutes is kind of a thing. But, I mean, we've already had to run. To kind of give you a funny story is, you know, last year at the Nationals, we're the other thing is it's organized in brackets, okay? They put five dogs in a bracket with your partners. And they take one dog out of the bracket to go to the finals in doubles. So a team had went out and put a very impressive 4-0-1. Okay. Very hard to beat. They smoked the field. The dog bounced perfectly. Everything went great. Well, we had Journey up next. And I said to my partner, Tim, I said, well, there's not a better time than now to have the best dog that I got on the trailer to go do this right now. And we went out and put up a 326 and smoked him and got in the finals.
Are you jogging? Are you jogging?
No, man. And people's eyes were just lined up. They couldn't even believe we did it because they thought a 4-0-1 was impossible to beat. And we came and just smoked them by, like, you know, 30-some seconds. Now, you think 30 seconds is nothing, but it actually, when I talk to you about the sport a little more later, it's huge. You know? Right. Yep. So, anyway, I mean, like I was saying, that's how intense it gets when you're talking about, like, a 30-second difference when people think that they got it down. And I mean, literally, you're always under the radar of, you're never safe in the game. There's always a team that can do well. It's so highly competitive. But one of the coolest training tactics that we train a dog in this thing to save time is, so I'm going to try to get you guys to hang with me, is we got a strategy, right? So I want him to be down to the middle of the field by the time I shoot the first bird. So whoever's dog it is, if it's my dog, and we'll just use Journey for an example, I'm going to shoot the gate bird. And what the gate means, this bird means it's the bird that's straight out in front of us, probably within 50 yards.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to walk out and shoot the first bird to get us started. And I want him to try to get as far as he can, because when I shoot, he has to stop as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then he can't advance until I get to reach or he gets to reach. What I want him to do is, as I'm working a dog into the wind and putting him in the right direction and the bird's getting up and I'm shooting all that time, I want him to march to get as close as he can to the middle of the field, because you got a front zone, a middle zone, and a back zone. So you're going to have one bird in the front, you have two birds in the middle of the field, and you have two birds in the back. All
gotcha.
Right? And so I want to send him as far as he can get to the middle. So picture this, right? The bird goes up, I shoot it. All right. Well, in a normal scenario, the dog brings the bird back to me, right?
Yeah.
Well, that wastes too much time. That's 10 seconds of wasted time for that dog to get to him to advance.
Do you cast him to that guy?
Boom. When I shoot a bird, as soon as that dog's mouth hits the bird, he starts blowing the whistle and the dog wheels straight over to him up the field, right?
Hell yeah, that's smart.
And it's an awesome thing, and it's a beautiful thing. So he's already close to the middle zone and working, and he's probably shooting a bird before I even get to the middle, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay. And then I'm going to march up towards the middle and go to, let's just say, the middle left of the field, right? Bam, he shoots a bird, I stop. Well, he's going to hang on to the dog and check the middle zone to see if the bird's there. By that time, I've come up and I've met him, and he's going to hand the dog off to me and head to the back.
Right.
Now, I'm going to sweep the left side of the field. Boom, I'm going to shoot. He's going to be standing between the middle and back zone. He's going to call the dog, and he's already going to be working to the back. So he's already going to kill. He's going to go back there. Boom, he's going to kill a bird. And because of plant cards and stuff, we probably know where our last bird is based on the strategy of the plant card.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to go and I'm either going to come in and back him up because I'm behind him, or I'm going to meet him, and he's going to hand the dog off to me the last bird, and I'm going to kill what's called the money bird. And then time, and then we're going to see what our time is to see if it was good enough.
So you're basically playing leapfrog.
Right.
And who developed that first strategy that, like, everybody's doing it in 10 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 minutes, you know, 9 minutes and a half, and then all of a sudden some joker and his teammate are like, hey, 4 minutes, suckers?
Yeah. Well, you know, now you're talking a whole nother wide answer, but genetics, player strategy, field management, and wind, you know.
Genetics kind of for, like, the people shooting?
Because Kevin and I share the same genetics, but I promise you, we don't share the same shooting.
Yeah, that could totally be it, too. There's definitely, you know, a shooting thing that we could touch on, too. But there, you know, genetics in the dogs. Yeah. You want a very fast dog who's got a big nose.
And biddable, you know, to be able to work with your teammate.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I would have strategized it like if it was Kevin and I. Kevin can't just come out that weekend, live 2 hours away from me, and, like, he and I show up and do it. It has to be, like, a teammate
right.
that can come over several days a week, work the dog. Dog trusts that person. It listens to them implicitly like they do to me.
That's I mean, we have a very similar voice.
It is
all
true.
Of the, this is,
we could win this
could
sucker.
Do,
we could be.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
How much time do we have to be way too obsessed over it?
1 year.
That's plenty of time to obsess over something.
1 year, yeah. January just started. We could drive right now. We'll live out west for a year.
You could do that.
We'll build a team. Kevin's having a baby soon, so we'll just forget that thing. It won't even remember him. It's not even going to remember him for a year. So we'll take a year off,
sabbatical,
and we'll do this.
Right.
Is there a cash prize?
Yeah, he said cash prize.
Yeah, but like,
yep,
big money,
worth it.
You gotta hit the ones with cash.
Yeah.
Oh, all right.
I love it, dude.
I could coach you along the way. Basically, that was kind of our dream when we were younger. You know, how every kid has the cowboy dream of going out and rodeoing and traveling from city to city and winning buckles and money.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of this with bird dogs. It's sweet. You know, it's cool. I mean, I feel like I'm a cowboy some days, waking up, pulling my dog trailer, which is, you know, my pseudo horse trailer. I got my gun, which is my pseudo lever action 30-30.
That's so cool, dude.
I feel like I'm a modern-day cowboy with my bird dogs rolling the country and taking people's money and rolling in and, you know, being the sheriff of the town.
That's super
town.
Cool.
What do you shoot while you're doing this?
Personally, I have a Browning Synergy is mine.
Oh.
And I actually modified my gun. A lot of people, that's the other thing, too, is, you know, you can't be afraid to step outside the box. I personally and us personally have always shot our top barrel first because we don't ever want to shoot a bird twice, right? I mean, there's times that we have to do it because it just presented a hard shot to see where our cards fall. But in general, we want to do it. So I personally shoot my top barrel first. So I actually have my gun. I actually had a situation where, you know, when you got over-unders, you can actually push your safety up and it goes in between barrels and it don't fire.
Right.
And I've done that at tournaments that have cost me championship wins. So I actually took mine to a gunsmith that my gun cannot fire what barrel. It only fires the top barrel first.
I shoot a Browning Satori. That's my every gun, duck, everything.
Yep.
That's all I shoot. And I've had it cost me a duck or two where you push forward. And now, when I especially when I first got it, where you're getting used to the whole thing, but now it's almost muscle memory. As I'm clicking the safety off, it's like I'm pushing my energy is over then up just to make sure that it's all the way
right,
over.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yep.
That's one last thing you want to think about in a bird dog tournament when the money's on the line.
Oh, yeah.
You pull up and all of a sudden the gun don't fire and it's like, so mine's been modified. But I like the Synergy. I'm really high right now on the 828, the Benelli 828. I'm probably going to switch over the summer to 828, but I'm not going to switch over guns until the off season.
Yeah.
And, you know, be able to shoot and practice with it all summer. I mean, at my facility, we train upland dogs and waterfowl and hunt test dogs all year round. So it's kind of neat at my place. I don't ever get bored because I got a team of waterfowl dogs I'm working at a team of upland dogs I'm working.
Yeah. Yeah, that's super cool.
So it's cool. I don't just have a hunt test all summer. And, you know, so it's kind of, that's what's kind of fun about my place. And then, you know, it's cool too because back to the people thing, like you're going to go hunt this world and meet a lot of people like you. And I've been in the Master National twice and met everybody around the country, all the top trainers, and trained with a bunch of them and had a good time. Went to seminars and then boom, shut the hunt test world off and go and know every single good upland bird dog player in the country. You know, so kind of like what you were saying the other day. I mean, I think pretty much every state in pretty much in the lower 48 here, I think I'd have a place to sleep on somebody's couch in every one of them.
Yeah.
If I needed one.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's neat.
So it's pretty sweet.
So let's talk about the training of this dog and, like you said, it's genetics and the training. How are you developing? Well, all right. I want to talk on that, but then I also want to talk about, like,
yep, for sure.
Yeah, the dog quarters the field. What else? Does it have to sit to a flush? Does it have to, like, do you release a dog? Like, if you, I'm assuming, have either run NAVDA or know NAVDA, the North American Versatile Hunting Dog Association, where, like, you can send the dog, but then you can't talk to them until they deliver, like, are there rules like that where it's super strict on obedience and this and that? Or is it like no holds barred, do it as fast as you can, least amount of flaws, or they add time? Like, how is the, what are the rules like, and how do you develop a dog?
Yeah, the latter, just what you said. There's rules, no holds barred, get them done as fast as you can with limited obedience. So with that being said, let's start from the beginning. I never teach a dog to heal until it's probably... Let's put it this way. All dogs go through four sets without knowing what heel is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so if so to kind of give you an inside view, like I'm building up a female right now. My next female, she's 6 months old, right? So her whole beginning life is about teaching her quartering patterns. And I can get into the details of that a little bit more, but let's just keep with that for right now. And for people to understand quartering, I basically want the dog to run in front of me from 10 o'clock to 2 o'clock at about a 20-yard space in front of me, and I wanted them to turn when they get about 10 o'clock in front of me. I want them to turn and go 2 o'clock and keep using the wind is what I want to do with quartering. But I want them to quarter and learn that the only thing in life that you need to know right now at 4 months old, well, actually already at 12 weeks old, but let's say 4 months old is when I really get serious with them, is I want to get them gun conditioned at 4 months old, and I want to shoot about 25 to 50 birds for them at 4 months old. I want them already, by the time they're 5 months old, to be a ripping little bird machine.
You're using
chuckers? And at that point, using chuckers.
Yep.
And at that point, I'm going to realize what kind of nose I got, which is back to genetics, right? And I'm going to realize what kind of nose I got. Do I got a hotter nose dog? Do I got a cooler nose dog? Do I got a nose that's too far on the ground? Do I got a nose that's head high? What kind of nose do I got? You know, do I got a pointing lab? You know, we got that mixed in here now. So I kind of get all that, you know, going. Now, obviously, whatever happens with the retrieve on live birds, because they're seeing more live birds than anything, you know, now at this point, you know, they're probably not bringing it back. They're playing the keep away game. And I got a check cord on them while I'm doing this so I can reel them in. But they're, you know, they're messing around with it on the way back. And So now it's time to quit the bird side because they're 5.5, 6 months old. Okay, now let's get the hear command and the hold command and the fetch command, and let's get all three of those things together and make sure that you know how to deliver properly to hand, right?
Yep.
And then I'm going to get you delivering a bird. I'm going to do some breaking marks. I'm going to let the guys whip frozen chuckers, and I want that dog to get back to me. And I'm actually going to create the hear command with the collar to, and I'm going to fast forward to this, the national champion, to where I'm going to nick the dog all the way back to me with the bird in the mouth.
Post-force
I want that
fetch.
Dog to come back to me post-force fetch.
Right.
I want that dog to come back to me so fast that all it thinks about when that bird gets in is the faster it gets to me, the better.
Right.
You know? And here's why. And I'm just going to jump over to the story. My best friend and I we can run four dogs each. This last national championship this last year in March, a year ago, right, we put three each in. So we had 6 of the 10 dogs in finals. Now, mind you, we can't talk to each other. They separate us. So we did it on our own to get there, right? He won it with a 4.01, and I got second place with a 4.02. Third place was a 4.10. Fourth place was a 4.22. And fifth place was a 4.47. They were all within 47 seconds of each other.
Right.
So now tell me how important it is that dog's coming back on that retrieve. Every second counts. You know.
Oh, literally.
So
literally
I'm already
1 second.
Teaching him. Literally 1 second I lost by. Now that can be him just fumbling the bird for 1 second. You know, I mean, it can be anything, but I mean, you literally don't. Now, if you think about it, in 5 birds you got to get, and let's say they mess up, they mess around with the bird for 3 seconds per bird. That's 15 seconds. Well, I just took 4th place.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, I mean, I need to put it in that perspective to understand how important the training of a...
These dogs need to be laser marking the downed bird. They can't go and hunt for the downed bird. It's shot, on it, deliver, go to next guy, shot, on it, deliver. Yep. So are they not sitting to a flush?
Okay, so yeah, back to that question, absolutely not, no. So
that's helpful.
Yeah, so you're not sitting flush. There's no standard of how the dog gets it. So let's just say a dog goes in and grabs the bird, right, traps it, and then they just bring it to you immediately. You just got awarded at all points. You didn't have to shoot that bird. You just got awarded.
Good deal.
You know,
well, that's good because a lot of these pen-raised birds and stuff, I'm sure that happens.
That happens, right? So now... Let's say the times are, I'm just giving you another scenario, the times are fast. So now I'm going to give you a higher level training. So, you know, back to where I was at with the puppy, I'm telling you how I'm training a puppy. And like, her name's Whisper right now. You know, another dog I want to mention or maybe talk about a little more later that hopefully we can bring up is my dog Winnie. She's a 2-time national world champion, 2-time national champion in 2 different organizations. She's a past the master national 2 times. She has qualifying 3rds and some jams. And she was a master hunter before she was 2, and probably the youngest senior pass there ever was. She had a senior pass 7 months, 3 weeks.
Holy crap.
So this dog is phenomenal. She's the brood matron of my place. And this is the last female puppy born out of her. This is the last litter out of her. And she only had 1 female, and this is the dog I'm talking about training right now.
Cool.
She's my last opportunity to make another Winnie. So I call her Whisper, the blast best kept secret, and I call her Whisper. And she's my next one coming up. So I'm just kind of explaining you what I'm doing with Whisper right now. She's 6 months old. She's going through force fetch. And when she's done with force fetch, I'm going to go right back to quartering and putting birds off for her. But now I'm going to start putting them in what would be a tournament set. I'm going to start teaching her the game, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to teach her to hunt yet. I don't really want her to hunt. I want her to learn how to go to bird to bird to bird.
Right.
How to shoot away from me. So let's talk about lines for a second. Remember I was telling you about running lines and blinds, and just like you guys are used to hearing on your show a lot,
yep,
or on your podcast a lot. So people don't understand this in the open world, but you understand it because you want an English setter. I understand it because I own an English pointer, and if you read a lot of pointer books, they send a dog on a line, right, to check objectives. And pointers that run field trials and horseback and stuff, they run a line. They talk about the dogs running a line. And they don't want the dog to derive from that line until it's checking an objective. And they want to watch its pattern of running them lines across those. And, you know, in them cases, it's very long. So I want the dog to shoot out. And I don't want the dog to quarter until I tweak my whistle twice. So when I'm leaving the gate, I want them to run a straight out line. Because I know the gaper is going to be 40 to 50 yards, right?
Straight ahead.
And the wind's going right to left. Picture
it, they don't put it anywhere. Is it? Do they put the birds in the same spot in the field? Or, like, you don't know where they are?
Okay, you draw a plant card. And the plant card will tell the planter different areas to put them in the field, but in the same general zone, okay?
Right.
They got what's called a gimme gate bird. Right. They got what's called a gimme gate bird, basically. And that means your gate bird's probably going to be within a 10 to 20-yard circle for everybody. So go out there, get successful on a gate, continue on. So you know that the gate bird's about 40 yards straight out in front of you. So I want... When I say hunt them up, I want this dog to take a line just like a blind and run 40 yards. The wind's coming right to left. I want them to be running an angle at like 11 o'clock for 40 yards. And when I tweet the whistle, come into the scent cone, depending where the wind is, put that bird up. And I'm going to meet him at the bird coming forward at the same time he's coming to the scent zone, and I'm going to shoot that bird in about 21 seconds.
Okay.
You know, that's how I'm going to start this race off. And I'm going to talk about singles now, not doubles now, because we kind of already touched on doubles.
Yep.
Now the wind's right to left. Okay, I got to go and get to the middle of the field. So as soon as that dog screams that bird back to me and hands it off, I want him to shoot at 11 o'clock again towards the left side of the field and run out there until I blow the whistle. I might send him on a 75-yard line to get there to see if he hits it on the way down. You know, and then now. Why would I send him a 75-yard? People that know my game would be like, Vaughn's crazy for sending him on a 75-yard line because he's out of range, and if he pops a bird, I have no prayer of hitting it, right? But it's going to go to another thing, to our training. Now, all of a sudden, Bob, our hunt test training is huge because when that dog's ears go out and turns, I instantly pull the sit whistle. And so the dog is staring at the bird. It's 5 yards away from the bird staring at it.
And then
I come up and say his name. I come up and say his name just like a retrieve, and he flushes the bird, and I dump it. You know,
ultimate control.
So I can ultimate control, ultimate range control, ultimate line control, and I can check. Like, just try to hang with me, right? If I want to clear out the left side of the field, I can be in the center of the field, and let him work left and come to me and check the center and then check the right. And I can send him on a line down there, and if he turns birdie, I can whistle set him and walk over there and shoot it. If he doesn't turn birdie, I can bring him to me and not waste any time, let him clear the whole zone out to me. So I didn't walk over to the left hunt, walk to the center of the field hunt, walk to the right of the field hunt. I let him show me whether there's a bird there or not.
Right. That makes complete sense.
And then if he shows me there's a bird there and I'm out of range, I pull the whistle set. Boom. Right? And I walk over there and kill it. Then I come to the center field and hunt because... Just so you have an idea, when we go to the middle of the field, you can have a center or a left center bird, a center right bird, or a split center left and right side of the field.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you can have, right? So I'm going to come and see if I got a left bird. If I don't have a left bird, I got to come to the center and let them hunt the center field. If I hit a center, I most likely got a right, and then I'm going to move down the field, right?
Right.
So that's how I'm going to play it. So I'm actually going to look at the middle as three boxes, three zones, 1, 2, 3 across the middle. And then I'm going to look at the back as 1, 2, 3. And there's going to be a bird in two of those three. Okay, that's how I'm looking at the field as I'm going up. And I'm using the wind, the dog's athleticism, and ultimate control to make that as fast as time possible. And then my expert shooting to make it roll as fast as time as possible. You know.
So on a singles, how fast is that in essence?
Well, I won like I told you, 401, 402, 4.
I thought that was doubles. Or it's the same with doubles. Like, no, it's just very consistent.
Yeah, when I said my partner, he was running singles, and I was running singles, and he had 3 in the finals, and I had 3 in the finals.
Wow.
We're only allowed to run 4 dogs.
Okay.
And that particular year, well, which is last year, he put 3 of his 4 dogs in the finals, and I put 3 of my 4 dogs in the finals. So, as as partners, as friends, we had 6 of the 10 dogs in the final. Now, here's a little caveat to kind of give you guys a better understanding. Him and I split the money we always had. So when we were younger, yeah. So when him and I were younger and we couldn't afford to run these tournaments because the entry fees were high, we went there splitting the entry fees and splitting the payout. That way we could afford to go to it.
That's cool, man. That's really cool, yeah, actually.
That's how we did it. So, like, I'll tell you a funny story. I mean, I really want to share the story because it's and we were just talking about it because him and I just hunted a weekend ago. Just got together and hunted and drank too many drinks. But anyway, there was a time it was like March and the championship was coming. So Mike, I don't think I'm going to go to the nationals. So he called me like February. I said, why, man? He's like, dude, I just don't have the money. He's like, I ain't going to have the money until I get my tax return back. I just got to do the right thing and be an adult. I said, well, your entry fee is going to be 800 and I got extra 800. So I'll give you 800. You're going. You just pay me back when you get your tax refund back. That's how we roll, man. That's when you talk about rodeo circuit.
Yep.
You know, where you're trying to get money to get in the car to go to the next rodeo. I mean, that's literally what we did.
That's so cool.
You know, I mean, there was times that we signed the check, both of him and I. Him and I still talk about it. We signed the check and said, we really don't have the money to cover this check that we're putting in. So, hey, buddy, let's make sure we go to bed a little earlier and not stay out, hang out with these guys too late. Let's make sure we put some money in. All we were happy is if we covered that check. Anything above that check was a bonus.
That's so cool, dude. That's so cool.
So, and we've been doing that. And he was my number one MMA fighter, so we had already had a bond in the fighting world. And we just transposed our adrenaline of MMA fighting into the bird dog world. But literally, we lived the life of a rodeo circuit. And then he started his own trucking company, and now he's got his own excavating business. You know, I'm running dog training, and you know how, well, you're going through right now, you know how fast building a new facility can suck every time you got. So, yep. You know, it's like, well, I should really, you know, steal off this wall a little bit more. But I got $2,800 in extra fees. I should really stay home because the $2,800 would steal off the wall. But no, you know what? I'm going to go gamble, and hopefully we can make this happen.
Yeah. No, that's so cool. That's so cool. So when you're talking genetics, let's take a second because we've been doing our best on the podcast to educate people on genetics and the importance of pedigree and what to look for. And we've talked with like Lyle Steinman on his big thing is old blood, quote unquote old blood,
right.
And who those dogs are in that old blood, and you know I know certain lines that I like. And what I've seen in training X number of dogs out of that sire or whatever, great marking, but man, they're finicky with pressure or whatever the case may be.
Right. I know that. I'm into this like you. I love it. Just
so
get the geek out.
Yeah. So what are the lines? Who are like the names that are nationally known? Or maybe they're not. Maybe they're smaller names, but man, you just know they got a nose and they got speed and they're a team player and they're not NFCs. They're Grand Hunting Retriever champions that put out bad to the bone flushing dogs. Like what do you work off of and what have you found and talk about that?
Yeah, great. Two or three dogs come to mind, but there was this dog that I'm going to mention first. And when we were in the game, it seemed like every dog that was winning to start with was out of grits. And he was very known out west. And it was like Bear Grits, and it was like a pointing lab title, or a pointing lab out of Bear Point Kennel in Wyoming. And these were like the guys that were in pointing labs 30 years ago before it's even popular nowadays, right?
Right.
And they called the dog named Grits. Grits of Bear Forest. That's what it is.
Are you saying
of Black Forest?
Grits or Grizz, like a grizzly bear?
No, Grits like the southern food.
Oh, yeah. Love me some cheese grits.
Oh, my God. I think that's so horrible, but you guys.
Come on, man. I live in the south part of the town.
Oh, man. The southern lifestyle of grits, man. I just can't get into it. But I do love a lot of other things about stuff. But they are. So it's Grits of Black Forest he wasn't coming, and now it just came to me. And he was from out west, and like he made a lot of pointing lab dogs, and I think he was only a senior hunter. But the people out there didn't care because, you know, out in the west, meaning Wyoming, South Dakota, you know, Montana, all them, all they care about is good pheasant dogs. A lot of them, you know. So this was the dog that seemed to produce out there the best pheasant dogs. In Minnesota, there was a dog called Rick's Risky Raider. And that dog was also in our pointing lab, and he had produced some of the best tournament hunting dogs in Minnesota that were very popular in that style, which that dog was also in the back of this cash dog that I told you about, Reamer's Instant Cash Machine, that I saw at the beginning of my career. And then you fast forward to my line, and a lot of people don't know this dog, or maybe you do, but if you ever heard of a kennel in Minnesota called Torx Labs,
yeah,
Torx did a lot of the Fox Reds, and you know I have a niche in the Fox Reds right now with Journey and Cowboy, but they had a dog in there called White Oaks Stony Berkey, and his name was Stony. And he's dead now, and he produced a lot of dogs, and he was qualified LH Master Hunter. I don't think Torx Labs even knows this. I'm kind of telling them something they probably don't even know. But Stony puppies from the early, 10 and on, 2010 and on, really would show up, and I can almost pick you out a Stony puppy. So Winnie is a Stony granddaughter.
Cool.
And I can almost pick you out a Stony dog. And then on the side, Winnie's top side, she has Concerto Charlie as her grandsire on that. So Winnie was out of a master hunter out of Concerto Charlie and out of a female that was out of Stony. But if you really go back and look at some of the dogs out of my kennel, you'll almost find Stony in every single one of my pedigrees. You know?
No way.
And I believe that's where it came from. I don't, it can be my own hypothesis of how it's going, but, and the thing about it is, like, I was standing one day at a national championship, the puppy championship, and this dog came walking by me, and they're about to run him, and he goes out and smokes a really good run. And I'm standing there, I'm sitting in my truck, and, you know, I'm a geek in genetics like you are yourself, and I geek out, and I roll the window down, and I say, hey, that dog got a Stony. He says, I don't know. I says, go see if you can find a pedigree on your phone and bring your phone back over here. Sure as crap, straight out of Stony. I picked it right out of the crowd.
No way.
Just because I know, like, the way a Stony's ground pattern, a Stony's head, a Stony's nose, I can kind of just see it.
Yeah.
Altogether. So there was that dog. And now, basically now, you got my genetics. I believe in an FCAFC pedigree, but I believe in an FCAFC pedigree that has upland proven genetics in their background. So I'm not interested in FCAFC that's never fed fun of them. I'm not interested in that. You know, I want to know, did you ever pheasant hunt this in the off season? Well, you already know from past conversations with everybody on this podcast, oh my God, don't ever upland hunt a dog. But some of the best field champions in their off season, their owners would take them home and go take a pheasant hunt. And that's the dogs I want to know about. I want to know about that.
Well, what's interesting, so can I digress for a second?
Yeah, for sure.
All right, so Master National, right? Up until this year, they always threw flyer pheasants on land and mallard duck flyers on water, right?
Right.
Do you know how many dogs that I trained with when I lived in South Carolina training that were preparing for Master National that their entire life, all they got were mallard ducks? That's all that we're throwing. Or, you know, hey, we killed some wood ducks, we killed some ring nests, and they got this mixed bag their entire life of retrieving ducks and training with ducks. You throw them a pheasant, flyer pheasant, and it lands, boom, right there. They just can't find it. They're walking all over it. And then you bring out old Uncle Bobby's buck, senior hunter, and he's making these Master National dogs look like fools because he's pheasant hunted a ton with me. He knew what to do.
Oh, man.
He knew that smell. And it was like, you know, all the other stuff, they were kicking his ass. But when it came to that pheasant flyer, he'd front foot it. And he never missed it. And I swear to you, that a dog that had pheasant hunted enough. Now, I do think, and we can maybe debate this, which would be fun, I do think a dog that over pheasant hunts, right? Like, life's about balance. We do too much of this, it's not good. We do too, you know, too much of that, it's not good either.
Right.
So if you over pheasant hunt and that dog trusts itself too much, then its nose is going to be on the ground too much to run in blinds and trust itself more than it trusts you. Poison birds might be harder when the heat of the moment is right there.
Right.
Things like that, yes, you're going to run into predicaments.
Right.
Not necessarily fully problems, but predicaments.
For sure.
But I do think that dog who has pheasant hunted and, like, super fired up over a rooster, you know, that they flush and they retrieve and it's kicking in their mouth and they're like, bah! They'll live for it. They'll never miss a rooster live flyer. They'll never. They'll front foot that sucker every time. But if they've never seen one, yeah, no chance.
And you just brought me to, such a great memory of that. I mean, you guys think 2013, I'm in Chinook, Kansas, in the first series of the AKC Master National. It's pheasant flyers, right? And they got one of those big Tangelo tossers that launches the suckers like 70 yards.
Yep.
I mean, and they're shooting a flyer at the arc at like 40 yards in the air, and then it fails because of the wind. And I ain't kidding you. I'm up winning with 67 and Bella with 73, and I still got the numbers here at my house hanging on the wall. And so, you know, I'm there and I'm nervous. It's my first Master National. I've traveled. I've been hearing about the Master National. And I ain't kidding you. The 11 dogs before me, every one of them couldn't find a bird or had a handle on a bird and could not find it, you know. And I'm thinking to myself at this point, you know, I'm nervous. It's my first one.
Of course.
You know, I've pheasant hunted and everything. But I'm like, oh, man, is scenting really that bad? I mean, is my dog going to have this hard of a problem finding that long flyer, which the flyer probably was 90 yards. With that big of an arc, it was kind of because dogs were fading at a gun and hunting.
Sure.
But, you know, and your big arc flyer was your final bird, your last bird down, or your last bird to pick up in general in this situation. So, and I'm just nervous as heck. And I got Winnie first. This girl I keep talking about, who's my main dog here, and I go up there and she marks them, and she sits there and she always sat like a rock. She never moved nothing, and her ears are up. And you know, I ship her on the short bird. I come back, I punch the other short check down bird. I come back and I rocket her straight out to that pheasant, and just exactly what you just said. She front foots it. I mean, she front foots it after previous dogs before me are blowing multiple whistles, and I'm nervous as heck because you know how it is the best natural. You're in holding blinds for like 9 holding blinds before you get to the line.
Dude,
and I'm just constantly hearing dogs get picked up.
You know? I had the bubble guts for like 14 days with a Master National.
Yeah.
Like 3 days leading up, I was nervous all the way till the end, nervous. Every morning you'd wake up and you're like, dude, the nerves of that event was unbelievable.
Right. So you understand what I'm talking about.
Oh,
so
yeah.
She goes up, smokes it, and runs a beautiful under the arc blind of the short check down bird. And come back, and I'm like, oh, man, that was sweet. And even the guy said to me, well, there was a guy that knew me from Wisconsin, my flight, and he said to me, oh, Vaughn, all that pheasant hunting's paid off, all that tournament hunting's paid off, huh? I said, yeah, sure looked like it. Well, 5 dogs later, I got to go back and, you know, obviously they tell you, hey, it's okay. You can go a little bit further down the line. So get back in. Just take your time with that dog. Get the next one out. So I get back and I go with my fellow dog. The exact same thing happened. She front footed every mark and pounded it. And,
sweet.
You know, yes, I agree with you on that 100%. When it got to the in that particular one, every land series was pheasants, like you said, and every water series was ducks, like you said. In that particular one, I mean, I passed both of them. My first Master National, I passed both of them. And when I was like progressively getting more confident and less nervous as I got to the 6th series of the week.
Oh, you know, God, I was going to throw up in the 6th series.
Yeah, you know, I was. I'll tell you what, we had a running water blind on that last series, just to divert just for a second. Yeah, I'm going to tell you what, this, get that dog where you need to give a walking over when you should, when it technically it's a back, and you want them to not let the current take them, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, please ride with the current or ride into the current and cut across the current to get the bird.
Oh, cool.
You know how it is.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Dude, I loved it.
I mean,
I hope that we can have one this year. I think we will. Now, I don't think they're throwing pheasants anymore. I want to say that the new rule is it's going to be Drake mallards every single bird.
Gotcha.
And I think the it makes sense because it's like, you know, every lighting of the day, every bird that comes out, a hen and a drake are going to look different across the skyline, and they're trying to make it more even for everybody. So I want to say, for some reason, it's going to be Drake mallards for everything.
Oh, that's pretty crazy. I didn't hear that, but that's really cool that they're going to think about being more fair to the dogs.
Yeah, don't quote me on it, but I'm 99% sure.
Right.
So, all right, let's dive back.
We're going back to genetics, right? This all started with genetics.
Yeah, somehow it started
I'm good with you. I'm just like you. So, you know, the people that want to hear about, hey, guys, can you get back to the genetics? So, anyway, you know, Stoney was another dog that's in the back of my life. But back to what you were talking about, what me and you jumped off on was, you know, I want the FCCs that went pheasant hunting. Tell me about that dog. Don't tell me about the FCCs that were on the truck and some pro ran them and the owners never got to see them. I really don't want to know about that. I don't get me wrong. I follow them in the national championship. I follow everything. Don't get me wrong. I'm going to keep that way too. But I'm saying that from a standpoint of what my goal is as a trainer and an upland competitor, an owner of a hunt club and a wild bird rooster chaser, you know, because I'm pretty crazy about doing my wild bird hunts, you know? So, I want to know the athleticism of a field champion. I want pencil legs. I want a dog no bigger than 70 pounds as a male, and I want it no bigger than 60 pounds as a female. I want a long body. I want a deep chest, all right? And I want a good nose. And I want tight eyes and tight feet. Now, that's completely opposite. The tight feet thing is completely opposite of what most lab owner breeders want. Why? Because they say we swim better if our feet are wet better, right? That's fine. Most dogs can swim just fine no matter what. You can get a rat here to swim good. I need a dog that when we're hunting in the crust of the snow in New York that doesn't cut their feet in the first 5 minutes and we can't hunt the rest of the day.
Right.
You know, and that goes back to my hound. That goes back to what I learned as a 13-year-old. When we genetically bred beagles, we bred for feet, deep chest, long body, pencil legs, good nose, right? Well, that all came back to me as an adult later on that I wanted to see in a lab. So when I'm looking at a pedigree, it starts there. Then it goes off on the genetics of, you know, all the way down to what you hear in the pointer world of the gait. I want a dog light on its feet, has a good gait. And if a dog's plodding and hard on the feet and its feet are loose and it's 80 pounds, you know, because they like to hunt bunch of ducks in Louisiana and they think that's going to make an upland dog, which somebody's going to offend about that, which I don't mean to offend your dogs, but 80-pound lab can do it. But I'm just saying that dog's not going to outlast my 60-pound pencil leg tight-footed female that's going through the cattails like a snake. You know, it's just not going to happen. And it's just the same as your lab isn't going to outrun my English pointer.
Right.
You know, and if you think that's going to happen, then you're kennel blind. And I don't know if people know this term because people don't use it too much anymore, but that just means you only see what you see in front of you. You can't look outside the box and realize that there's other things in the world that can be better. You know, so I am constantly studying the genetics across the country, and I got a fox red niche. So I am like constantly studying the number one fox red here. I want to piece this and this because, Bob, have you ever read the book Snakefoot, The Making of a Champion by Robert Welly?
No, but, well, first of all, Mike, I'm not a big reader, and I think everybody on this podcast knows that. I read Where the Red Fern Grows, and that's about the extent of Bob's education. I'm kidding. But
that's a great education.
Bob Whaley was the president of Genesee Brewing Company, which is from Rochester, New York.
Right.
And he had L. Hugh pointers. That was like his line of English pointers that were here in New York. and he has a state park that's about 35 minutes from my house.
That's awesome.
Little known fact.
I totally want to visit that.
Oh, it's awesome. Dude. Yeah. It's so beautiful. And the statues and the artwork. Yeah, oh, it's so cool. But if you're telling me I should read this book, I'll probably get it book on tape, but I will get it.
Yeah, I think you should, because it'll open you into my world a little more, and it'll make you understand what I'm about to say right next, what I'm about to do now. So now that I got my females in play, and like I said, I got a fox red niche, and I'm playing with that. It doesn't mean I don't own yellows. I own some yellows, but I'm going to figure out how I'm going to. 10 years from now, when you look down my string of dogs, they'll be all as red as Dan and Anna on Puerto Red Bird Girl.
Cool.
I mean, that's just the way. That's where I'm going, right? And I love it, and I've been fascinated with it from the first one I've seen, and I just kept the fascination going. But I really, you know, now, and you know it already with the field trial world and stuff, and I'm sure there's a lot of people listening that will understand it. Line breeding, right?
Yep.
And so now,
describe it though. So if we have talked about it, but describe it.
Okay, so I'm going to describe you what line breeding means to me, and everybody's got their different ways, but line breeding is to try to keep creating a dog with stronger traits of the same family gene pool, all right? And so I might, so let's say I got one dog as a great grandsire on one side, and I might bring that dog through as the grandsire on the other side, or I might have it as a sire on one side and the great grandsire on the same side, because I'm trying to bring, let's say for Stoney, I'm going to go back to Stoney. If I could get Stoney one generation apart in a pedigree for my best upland dog, that would be kind of almost my ultimate pedigree.
Right.
You know, for just tournament hunting. I'm not talking about hunt tests or nothing right now, or field trials hunting. Just for that, right? So I'm trying to line breed. My next thing is, and the reason why I mentioned Snake with the Making of a Champion is because Robert Welly developed the LHU pointers. And he goes in there and tells about line breeding and then when the time was to outcross and when the time wasn't and when to get rid of the outcross. And he really goes in there and describes his genetics of how he did it. And that fascinates me of how I'm going to do that for tournament dogs and master hunters by the time they're two. So my whole goal of my pedigrees is you got to be a master hunter within your two-year-old year, okay? And you got to be able to be an upland champion. You got to show me you can be an upland champion, preferably before a year, but I might give you till 2 years, you know. And I will sell you if you're a master hunter at 18 months old, but you suck in the upland bird dog world, I'll sell you.
Right.
If you're a awesome upland dog and you can't mark your way out of a wet paper bag, I'll sell you too.
I got you.
So those are my standards as a breeder now. Now, it's hard because you already know it's Bob, and you got the dogs that you love, and you got the dogs that you love to train, and this is so hard to talk to you about, but I want to mention this while there's people listening. That does not mean that I am degrading everybody else's breeding. That's just what I like to do. That's just my fascination with the dogs I love. I got show dogs here. I got pointers here. I got pointing labs here. I got field trial dogs here. I got dogs here that nobody even knows who the parents are.
Yeah. Right.
I mean,
yep, same.
So as a trainer, the trainer in me, I don't look down on your dog because it's not out of my breeding, and I know you don't either because otherwise you'd never train anybody else's dogs, right?
Right.
But as a breeder and as a competitor, like Lyle Simon said, he likes the old blood, I know that what dogs I like to make me successful in what I want, you know, and that's what I want to make sure people understand because everybody starts at your first dog. So you can bring your first dog to me training or me helping you become a bird, upland bird dog tournament hunting or, you know, becoming an AQC master hunter, whatever your goal is. And we're just going to train the dog you put in front of me because I'm a trainer.
Right.
But if 10 years from now, back to bird dog wars, what we're talking about, the genetics of bird dog wars, you know, the reason why I've been staying on top of the game. Now, mind you, let me throw a little tidbit in. I'm just going to, you know, kind of float my own boat for a second here, but and it's kind of fun. And the last three national champions have been bred by us and have been trained at my facility in the BDC. So the last 3 years running, I have trained the national champion. You know,
that's awesome.
So when I tell you, nobody's, and every one of them is a master hunter.
That's That's even better.
And every one of them was a Master 100 in their two-year-old year. So that's when I said that earlier in this cast about I'm the number one doing that. Yeah, but I know the genetics I like to train, you know. And there's times when in genetics where it's like, okay, I need more marking again. I got too much nose over here or vice versa, you know. But in general, going back to my original thing of line breeding, which you're wanting me to get to, line breeding should keep producing me the same dog that I want to compete with. So I am trying to line breed the dogs that make me successful so that 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 20 years from now, you're going to see my champions right now still in the pedigrees. And as you know, it's phenomenal. Like Journey and Cowboy are getting stored like once a month. I'm taking them to get stored once a month. 15 years from now, I can be like, I wish I could breed that female to Journey because that would have made a really good pairing. Well, I can. That's how phenomenal it is nowadays. It's awesome.
Yeah, that's super cool.
50, you know, and that's where I want to be sitting. I want to have 100 some straws on each dog and go, 15 years from now, I go, this female would match up perfectly with Journey. And I'm going to breed her a Journey, and all of a sudden I got a Journey puppy 15 years later. And guess what? It's the same genetics I won with 15 years ago, and I got it right now. I just fast forward 15 years later. That's what's in my head right now.
That's really cool, man. That's really cool. So you're gearing up for March. Well, today is January 17th? 19th? I don't know what day it is. 19th, it's mid-January.
Yep, 19th, yep. You're a dog trainer.
2021. And so you're gearing up.
I saw my help. What day is it?
Yeah. You're gearing up for March. What are you doing? Like, we're trying to peak dogs, right, for Master National, for a bunch of master tests coming in the summer. We're trying to get dogs right and peak when we need them. What are you doing in your program right now for the dogs that are going to compete in March?
All right, the word peak you just said is magical. I am now trying to we're in the north. Fortunately, I'm going to be training in Georgia for the next month. I'm leaving in a week and a half to train in Georgia for a month. But in general, when I stay up here, I got to beat the heat, right? I'll leave here in probably 20 degrees and go down and compete 50. Well, that's a big adjustment.
Huge.
For the dogs. There seems to always be a day at the Nationals that gets up to 50 or 60 degrees, and my dogs have only seen negative 10, and the highest thing they've seen is 20 degrees for the last being up here in Wisconsin like you are, right?
Right.
So all of a sudden, conditioning becomes huge. And I'm trying to, when you're saying peak, I'm trying to get this dog conditioned to a point that I feel they're peaking to where I can run with maximum output on their conditioning program so that when the heat hits them, the conditioning will hopefully make up for what the heat's going to hit them with.
Right. Okay. Yep, makes sense.
Now, with that being said, I'm giving them birds about 2 days a week to see where their nose is at, see how their lines are at based on me setting up the scenario of what's gonna happen. I'm conditioning the other two days a week, 2 to 3 days a week. And so Monday, okay, they got the weekend off. Monday, I'm going to take these dogs out, and I'm going to run them on my track, and I'm going to run them aerobic and anaerobic, just like you would in martial arts, just like I did back in the martial arts with my fighters, right? So I want this dog to run anaerobic at about 14 miles an hour, and then I'm going to blitz for like 250 yards or 300 yards with a four-wheeler at as fast as that dog can run. And that's going to simulate that retrieve there and back. Then I'm going to let him go back down to 14 miles an hour.
Right? Are you doing this free running, or you're not going as fast as you can with a roading harness, right?
No.
All free running.
No roading harness. No roading harness because of the fact of what I want to do with free running. And I want to push the dog.
Okay.
I mean, it's hard to believe, but a lot of times, my dogs are going 29, 32 miles an hour. Fastest dog I ever had here was 33 miles an hour. And what I'm also watching for while I'm conditioning them is, will you quit me? And then that transposes over to hunting later. Will you quit me, or will you keep going?
Right.
You know. And you know, we talk more about that later. We're talking about competition right now, and I don't want to get off subject. But so I want to see if you'll quit me. And sometimes I do it for time. Sometimes I do it for number of laps. It doesn't matter. But Monday, I'm going to take them on, give them an easy, probably 5-lapper. They're going to be out there for probably a total of 6 minutes. And I'm going to do that on Monday, and I'm going to put them up, and then I'm going to let them rest. And then I'm going to make sure they're eating high-performance dog food. And then I'm going to probably give them a few extra vitamins, and I'm probably going to have glucose to me, and I'm going to hit a little bit of that because I want, you know, them to replenish a lot better because I'm pushing them a lot harder. You know, and I'm going to keep the weight off of them to where you're seeing ribbage, but not to where they look skinny, you know what I mean?
Yep.
And I want them there. So now I'm going to do that. Tuesday, I'm going to give them long marks in as thick as grass as I can find. So I want them to do marks in as thick as grass as I can find, and I want them to go just mark. Just go and run like 6 marks. And I want them to get in that mark in as thick as cover as fast as they can and dig it out and get it back to me as fast as they can. So we're just going to do 5 or 6 marks on Tuesday. And then Wednesday, I'm going to condition you again. Okay? And Thursday, I'm going to run a pattern with all frozen birds. I'm going to work on your cording. I'm going to work on your whistle. I'm going to stitch you to every single bird on frozen birds. So they're going to turn on the bird. They're going to go in and want to smell it. I'm going to sit them to every single bird. I'm going to work only control on Thursday while they're running a tournament field pattern, right?
Yep.
And then Friday, I'm going to go out and do the real thing with you. I'm going to go out and shoot you. I'm only going to shoot the last 2 birds live. Sometimes I'll do a full set of 5 birds, but in general, I'll do 3 dead birds in front and middle zones, and I'm going to shoot the last 2 birds. And the reason why I want to do that psychology-wise for the dog is I want them to want to think about getting in the back of the field as fast as possible because that's when they get the live birds.
All right, so,
you know, in the hunt test world.
I'm going to stop you real quick. That's super
smart
and something that we've heard before on the podcast with Clark Kennington where – he throws a ton of live flyers at the longbird and building that confidence, that drive, that desire, that passion to go further, harder. And so to, you know, honestly, for an older dog who's been through the paces to go pick up a dead bird while they're quartering is like, meh, all right, yeah, I'll sit to this one. Sure, I'll go get it. And then to know that, like, all right, baby, that was like 2 or 3. There's got to be a live one here. There's got to be a live. And bang, here it goes. Mentally,
right.
Mentally, you're really pushing them to get through the course to get their reward.
100%. And that's their live flyers are going to be the last 2 birds. So I want them to, you know, go there. Then, and I'm going to do that on Friday. And during that, just like we do in our retriever training, in our retriever thing, I'm going to take notes. Did the dog stop and check old nests too much? Did it have its nose down too much? Was it running head high? Was it hitting the wind right? You know, because I'm going to play the wind, and I want to see if the dog's using the wind right. So let's just say, for an example, the hardest wind to play this game and the hardest wind to hunt in is the wind that we use for hunt test setups, which is the wind at your back,
right?
Well, when you're upland hunting, that's the hardest wind because I'm shooting you forward on line, and then you got to come back into the bird to smell it. Well, the smart champions like Winnie and Journey and Cowboy and my top, you know, 4 right now that I'm running that I believe I can win anything with. And Lyle Simon taught me one thing about this that I'll get on in a second. He just taught me a mentality that I really like. Anyway, that dog needs to shoot out. And when I tweet the whistle, it needs to run the wind and turn its head back towards me as it keeps running. That's what it needs to do, you know. So the dog actually turns its nose into the wind as it keeps running, and then smell the bird and turn into me. That's what the dog needs to do, you know.
Yep.
So that and then they need to do that all the way down. So I want to watch. So I actually want to train a lot of times in my fields at my hunt club and in my training field at my house and stuff. I actually want to train with the wind at my back because that's the worst wind, you know.
Agreed.
So I want to get them dogs used to. I want to get them dogs used to being the fact that when the wind's at your back, that's the worst wind you can be in, and then everything else becomes easy. If I got a crosswind or I got a headwind, you know, and that's where I'm training. I'm not doing that all the time, but I want to see if this dog's running the right line to smell the wind. So when I talk about running lines, shoot out. Okay, now when I tweak the whistle twice. Turn 90, run across in front of me, but turn your head towards me to smell that wind because that wind's behind you. And then when you smell it, turn it in and put it up so I can shoot it. You know?
That's super cool, dude.
So
that's super cool.
So a lot of it is transition. I'm glad I'm getting to talk about this because I don't get to talk about this much, and I think the country needs to know how technical a true upland bird dog is running. It's the same technical as running a blind or anything else. It's just a different game, you know?
Yeah. Truthfully, I would say I was, what do you want to call it? I don't know. My mind is drawing a blank, but I figured, you know, have you ever seen a roustabout? Like the Boykins in South Carolina, for instance. The Boykin folks, they do this thing called a roustabout. It's literally the same thing you're doing, but there's no real rhyme or reason, and I don't think anybody, if they were to listen to this and implement what you just discussed, they would go win the roustabout and win money and have fun and up, you know, beat everybody. Because
right.
It's not just go walk a field and let your dog find them, and you got to make sure you hit them and your dog's got to deliver it. Like, as simple as it is, it's not.
Right.
It's
right.
It's precision. It's, like you said, I lost by 1 second. And when you're competing to win instead of just pass, it comes down to if it slips the whistle, if it takes a bad line, they've got to miss a bird once in a while. I mean, there's got to be a dog out there in the championship, down to the wire, the money's on the line, and it just runs past a bird and breathes out instead of breathes in, and you're like,
100%.
Oh, there's 20 seconds right there.
Yeah.
And it might still find the bird and boom, put it up, you kill it and bingo bango, but it doesn't hit that wind right and you're out, technically not out past fail, but you're out of the running because it took 45 seconds to win that bird.
100%.
And so I looked at it like the roustabout, and you watch these guys and there's quail out there and their little boykins run around and they have a great time. And they got some money on the line. It's just like fun betting type of deal. There's no titles. It's just part of the fun. But good Lord, if they listen to this podcast and like actually train for it, they could clean house, man.
Oh yeah.
They could clean house.
This is the inside view. I'm giving you a lot of inside views. It's taking me, 11 years in the game to put it all together. And it's my own blend of hunt test training to the upland bird dog world, doing it and really seeing it from a deeper level and really sitting down with the best tournament hunters in the game and seeing what they were seeing, really being a student of the game. All these little tidbits along the way just accumulated the things that I was telling you about.
Yeah.
So preparing for the national that you just asked me about and what, the people who are listening to this podcast need to know is that there's very serious steps I'm taking to try to make what would be the fourth national champion in the row, so that's what I'm obviously shooting for right now.
Good for
and I have, 16 dogs here that are going to the national championships, probably even more this year. Some are going to be running the puppy under 2-year-old division. Some are going to be running just doubles. Some are going to be running the singles, but some are going to be handled by their own owners because I can only run 4 dogs. But, it's very prideful for me, too, to train a dog and watch a person grow as a player in the sport. Like, you come out, hang out with me, Bob, for a month. I show you about how to take your best dog that's your best pheasant dog and turn it up on tournament and see you go play a tournament for the first time and see what kind of success you can have.
Yeah.
So I'm a coach on that, too, and that's why I do my seminars on that. And you guys can follow me on all this stuff, too, later on. So that's the deep of it. But, back to what you just said, you brought up a perfect story, if you don't mind, on what you just said. In the 2018 World Championships, which the national is in the March and the world is in the fall, the world used to mean that any organization could come compete. It was kind of an open invite to anybody from any organization. Winnie's in the finals. Going back to my girl Winnie, I've been talking about, she's in the finals, and this is Bird Dog Wars. Let's go back to Bird Dog Wars, right? The cameras are on me. Let's go back to this for a minute. There's also the same as, can you imagine being at the Master National, and then before you go in to run your Master National run with your dogs, you're getting interviewed, you know, just before you go in.
Yeah, I'd be like, you know, hold on, I'm hitting the porta potty quick.
Yeah. So just before you go in, they're sitting down putting a mic on you, pulling you up. They're prepping you for what they're going to ask you so you can think about it quick. And you're on the spot. At the same time, you're trying to keep the zone of how you're going to win this thing, you know, while they're interviewing you. What do you think about this? What's your strengths? What do you think is going to happen if you do this, right? So season three is about to come a Bird Hardware. Season one got on YouTube. Season two's first episode made YouTube, but they didn't put the rest of season two up there. Season three is supposed to happen, right? It's actually the most amazing year that we had. And Winnie's in the World Championships, and there's a camera crew behind me. And they're following me through the field. And then they got a big lift that you'd use for building buildings out in the middle of the field, off out of bounds. And they're filming. They got a camera up in there, too. And they got a cameraman walking right behind you with the judge. And you got a mic on the whole time that you're out there, right? So you're going out there, and now the pressure's really, like, not only are you got to run your run, you got the camera crew on you, and they're going to edit things, so you got a lot of pressure on you. You got to shoot properly. So I go out there with Winnie, and I run a 7-minute run, okay? And I get done, and it was a good run, but it wasn't that, oh, you're going to have to be a good man to beat me run.
Right.
You know, it wasn't that run. So I run this run, and they're doing the, they like to do an interview right at the moment. Right when you get the last bird in the hand and you're all pumped up, they like to do an interview with you. So the cameraman says, hey, Mike, how do you feel about that run? And where they're going, no, it's an army run. I said, this should be done in 5 minutes. I think I left 2 minutes on the table. It's just okay. Well, then the guy says again, well, no, if you thought you were doing good, you know, what would you think? I said, well, that's not really that good. I just kind of repeated what I said, and I kind of didn't get it. Later on, the producer comes to me, and here's the deal. I get back to the trailer. I'm done running Winnie. And they finally say to me now, because I have no idea what's going on. That's another thing I need to let the people know I'm talking. They do what's called sequestering. So the day of the finals, they take your cell phone so nobody can text you and cheat anything. You are sitting in a clubhouse by yourself, and they call you when it's time for you to go run the field, and they take you to a field that you don't know. You've never been there, and they mic you up and put a camera on you, and you got to figure out the strategy of this field when you step to the gate. You've never seen it before.
So you don't know what anyone else has done.
And I don't know what anyone else has done either, right? Until I'm done running my dog.
I like it.
Yeah, so they sequester us, so you don't have any clue what's going on. You have no information. So now, when the finals come, it's the best of the best of who can go out, go to an unknown field with your dog, play the wind, run the line, shoot the birds, and do it in the fastest time as possible. This is the level we're at now, with a camera crew asking you questions before you start and following you the whole way through, right? And so you go out there, and you're done. Get back to the truck, and I'm going down, and I'm done. They said, well, there's only one run left. And I come down to get my equipment. They take me back to the sequestered area, and they drive me. By the way, they're doing this side-by-side. They transport you side-by-side with your dog or the dog box in the back, and they drive you back there. And they get to the back there, and I said, Vaughn, don't you want to go run this last run? I said, why? They go, well, you're winning it right now.
Ooh.
I said, what? You know, so didn't know that the interviewer of the camera guy is trying to get me to, like, be pumped up about my run. But I wasn't pumped up. But to go to the story of what you touched on earlier, I had run King, which was a Winnie son, and he was a very good dog, too. He's retired now because he hurt his leg. But I had run King through there, and I ran like an 8-minute run. They were putting this bird at the bottom of a hillside, right where the hillside met the hill going up and the hill flattening out. Well, if anybody knows anything about bird flattening, that's the spot where the wind blows right over it. They can't smell it, you know. So I had brought King through there and got that bird earlier, but at like 8 minutes. And so as I can't find this last bird of Winnie, and I got four birds in 4 minutes thinking this is over, I'm going to have that run that's going to be hard to beat, right? I spend three more minutes looking for one more bird like you're talking about, like you said.
Right.
So finally, I think to myself, I mean, you know, after all, you're like stupid me. I finally think to myself, just check the bottom of that hill where they can't smell. It's just been hitting every bird perfect. So I come down this hill, and I'm thinking it's about here. She flushes the bird. Now, she's coming down the hill, and the bird's going up from the bottom of the hill, right? Well, the camera crew is behind me. As the bird goes straight up, she leaps off the hill. I'm at the bottom of the hill. She's like 4 feet over my head, and she catches this bird out of the sky right in front of the camera crew and like falls down to the bottom of the hill, which is probably about 10 feet at this point, and turns and spins like on a dime because she's been trained her whole life. She's 8 years old at the time. It gives me like a 2 second retrieve, right?
Nice.
And the camera goes, holy crap, man. That's the coolest thing ever. Holy man, dude. I can't wait to put this on Bird Art Wars season 3. This is amazing. Well, then goes into what I just said, asking me about this amazing interview. What would you think of your winner right now?
And you're
so
like,
the story goes to this. And I'm like, the story goes up. Vaughn, you want to go watch? No way I'm winning. Well, then the producer comes up to me. Vaughn, he said, well, a really key thing to me. He says, Vaughn, you got to realize, man, the way you've been playing this game, if you're struggling with the bird, everybody else is. He says, your dogs are too good. You've done this too long. And that was true. Everybody went full. A lot of people couldn't find that bird that you're talking about. Just spot the dogs couldn't come out. You know? And I happened to do it in 7 minutes and happened to win the world championship in 2018 with Winnie.
That's super cool, man. That's super cool.
Just cool things like that, you know?
The world takes us in unbelievable places and get to see some unbelievable things with our dogs. That's for absolutely sure.
Right.
All right, Mike. We've been rolling for like damn near 2 hours. Easy. Easy conversation. I know.
I appreciate you guys hanging with me.
You were awesome. So what I'd like to do is give you a chance to tell everybody where they can learn about you, your kennel, your hunting club, and where they can watch and learn more if they want to join, like the Bird Dog Wars and the Upland Challenge. Give that a spiel.
Yep. Well, look me up on the Blast Wing Shooting Kennels, Facebook. Michael D. Vaughn is my Facebook, and it's my Instagram. I got to get a kennel page up there. The Rush of the Flush is my hunt club. That's also on Facebook and Instagram. And then the National Bird Dog Circuit, which is the BDC, is where you can find the events. And then by getting connected with me on social media, you know, I'll have my Upland Bird Dog Seminar where I teach people how to do this sport. And then kind of what we were talking about at the beginning of this, you know, I'm going to be starting an online series for not only, you know, waterfowl dogs, which people like what I do there too, but there's no Upland Bird Dog online course in the country, so I'm about to fill that niche. So hang tight on that, my friend.
Cool, dude. Cool. And if they want to find some of these episodes of the Bird Dog Wars on YouTube, do they just search Bird Dog Wars?
Yep, search Bird Dog Wars. You'll see me on there, and it'll be fun. If anybody wants to contact me, how to get in the game, or you know, how to buy a puppy, or the training that it takes, or whatever, I'd be happy to help anybody. I mean, a lot of people that are playing the game nowadays, because I help them out, which is cool.
That's awesome, you know, man.
It's like when I coach martial arts.
I love it, man. I loved this episode. I loved having you on. You're energetic, charismatic, bad to the bone. I loved it. So everybody.
Yeah, well,
go ahead.
Well, I just want to say to you, Bob, thank you very much. The things that I just talked about for the last hour and a half or 2 hours are things that I've wanted to say for a long time, and I appreciate you bringing it out and letting me get it off so people can hear it, because it's very, very important to me on kind of my legacy and things that I'm doing in my life. So I appreciate you bringing that out of me, my friend.
Oh, happy to have you. Please, you know, our pleasure. And we'll do it again, especially after March. We'll have to schedule you for like an April to talk about the March tournament. All right.
Yeah, do that. Let's do April, and I'll tell you how the Nationals went, and we'll get back to it, my friend.
Heck yeah. All right. Stay safe, travel safe, work hard. Win that son of a gun, and everybody check him out. Oh, Mike, thank you so much for being a part of it. We'll catch you guys on the flip side.
Hey, patreon.com/LoneDuckOutfitters. It's a community that we built to help you and your dog on your journey to next duck season. There's videos that don't hit YouTube. There's happy hours where we drink a couple beers and I answer your questions every other week. And by the way, if you join between now and September 1st, you're entered to win a hunt with me and Kevin and other Patreon members. So jump in. Let's go. Join the community. We appreciate it, and we'll see you there. We'll be right back.
Hey, listeners, Nick Larson here, host of the Bird Shop Podcast. As fans of this show, you may be interested in the conversations on the Bird Shop Podcast, where we discuss all things upland hunting, from upland birds and their habitat and conservation to the shotguns, bird dogs, and gear used to pursue them. Whether you're a seasoned upland hunter or just getting started and wanting to learn more, I interview a wide range of guests, each with their own unique perspective and valuable experience to share. If you're on the hunt for more upland hunting conversation, please consider subscribing to the Bird Shop Podcast today.